and welcome to this special podcast. It's an extended cut of Corey Hazlehurst's interview with former Labour MP Chris Mullin. So you'll have heard the partial thing on episode 163 of The Pod Delusion, but now here's the longer version in full.
Chris Mullin is my political hero. Announcing this is perhaps necessary in the interests of full disclosure, even if it probably does compromise any journalistic impartiality I have for this piece. Chris Mullin was MP for Sunderland from 1987 until his retirement from the House of Commons at the last election in 2010. During his time as an MP, he served as a minister in the Department of Transport and then at the Foreign Office, as well as serving as chairman of the Home Affairs Select Committee twice, from 1997 to 1999 and then from 2001 to 2003. Chris Mullin devoted most of his career to issues of injustice and civil liberties. Before becoming an MP, he produced a documentary for Granada's World in Action series, casting doubt on the convictions of the Birmingham Six pub bombers. This was expanded into a book called Error of Judgment. The end result of this campaign was the release of the innocent men in 1991, and a commission was set up, eventually leading to the establishment of the Criminal Cases Review Commission. As an MP, Chris Mullin continued to campaign on civil liberties issues, voting against New Labour's rather daft plans to detain terror suspects for 90 days without charge. He also received praise for being one of the lowest claimants during the MP's expenses scandal. Essentially, Chris Mullin is a decent man of principle, who's attracted quite a bit of notoriety over the past decade thanks to the publication of his three volumes of diaries. The Times' chief political commentator Peter Riddell said that these deserve to become the central text for understanding the Blair years. He's also written some novels, of which the most famous is A Very British Coup. This was written in 1982 and was set in 1988. A populist left-wing Labour government has just taken power, and the novel charts the attempts of the media, in collusion with the Secret Service and the Americans, to try and remove the government in a bloodless coup. There was a TV adaptation of the novel made in 1988, starring Rayne McAnally as Labour Prime Minister Harry Perkins, and this was scripted by another of my favourite people ever, Alan Platter. Channel 4's current miniseries, Secret State, is also inspired by the novel. I met with Chris in Birmingham to discuss the novel 30 years on. I started by asking him what the inspiration was behind writing it.
Well, of course, it was written in 1981 too, and the political climate was very different in those days. There was a prospect of a government led by Tony Benn, which was causing panic both amongst the Labour establishment and amongst the non-Labour establishment. Cruise missiles were coming into the UK, American cruise missiles, which many people thought would make us a target rather than defend us. And they were attracting huge hostile demonstrations. And the political climate was much more volatile as well. And there was speculation as to what would happen if a government led by someone like Tony Benn were to come to power and say, try to remove the American bases, or at least the nuclear weapons in the American bases. And I was coming home from the Labour Party conference in, I think, 1980 with Peter Hayne, who later became a Labour MP, Tony Banks, who later became an MP, and Stuart Holland, who was already a Member of Parliament. And we were discussing exactly this question. And Stuart said, well, he'd just tapped out the opening chapters of a novel by the swimming pool in Greece based on exactly this proposition. And Peter Hayne revealed that he and a friend had circulated an outline for a novel on exactly this subject. So I thought, goodness, I'd better get on and do this.
Try and write it quickly.
So that's how A Very British Coup came into existence. Years later, at a book club in Ipswich, I was talking about A Very British Coup, and I was approached by a man called Peter Hardiman Scott, who was the BBC's chief political correspondent in the 1970s. He was the Nick Robinson of his day, a very famous man in his day. And in retirement, he'd been writing thrillers. And he said that when my book was published, he was two-thirds of the way through a novel based on exactly this proposition that what would happen if a left-wing government was elected. And his publisher had advised him to junk it because it was too late. Now, I was very lucky. If it had been the other way around, I was an unknown. Mm-hmm. If he'd got there first, I don't think I'd ever been heard from. Mm-hmm. because he was very well known.
Yes, because at that point, were you editor of Tribune at that point?
Not at that point,
not quite at that point.
I wrote for Tribune, but I wasn't the editor of it. No, I was a completely obscure figure.
Okay. One thing I wanted to ask was how much, after the novel was published, and there were rumours of Harold Wilson being the subject of an MI5 plot. I mean, were these rumours around in the early 80s, I think?
Was it? Yes, some of them were, but events did play into my hands to make the book topical. For example, well, the first thing that happened, actually, when we published the hardback, we used to sell it through an advert at the back of Tribune.
Okay.
And the first cheque for £7.95 that came in came from the American Embassy. And so we duly packed it up and sent it off and waited to see what would happen next. And the next thing that happened was an invitation to lunch with the minister at the embassy, the minister, the most important career diplomat in the embassy. There came a day when his bulletproof Cadillac came round to Tribune's multi-story headquarters to collect me and convey me to his mansion in Kensington. When we got there, I said, I'd assumed there'd be quite a lot of us at this lunch. But no, there was just him and me and one of his officials and a Filipino butler. And I said to him, "What on earth are you doing bothering with a minnow like me?" He said, "Well, I reckon you're among the top 1,000 opinion formers in this country." So I said, "Well, I must be about number 999. He said, "The other 999 have been here too."
Oh, that's fantastic.
I didn't follow up your other points about MI5 and so forth.
Yes.
Quite a few of the things that are in the novel that are only speculation in the novel, such as, for example, I had a spy, an MI5 agent on the Council of C&D, came to pass. That turned out to be a chap called Harry Newton, we discovered later.
Oh, right.
And he'd been an agent of MI5 for many years. He was the treasurer of C&D, so they must have had every detail. I had a man in the BBC who was vetting senior job applications, and that turned out to be Brigadier Ronnie Stoneham, who was stamping upturn. He was rumbled in 1986. He was stamping upturned Christmas trees on the personnel files of people who were not to progress. Of course, then there was Spycatcher, again in 1986, I think, when a former senior member of MI5, Peter Wright, revealed that he and a small group of colleagues had suspected that Harold Wilson was a Russian spy and had been spying on him for quite a long time, and indeed may have undertaken some activities with a view to destabilising the then Labour government.
So if you were going to update the novel now, I know that Secret State is loosely based on the very British coup, but if you're going to try and sort of set this in 2012, when I suppose there's less debate now about the role of cruise missiles and about nuclear weapons here, if you were going to try and update it, I suppose, for the coalition, for the internet age, have you thought about, say, who you might want to base Harry Perkins on? If not, maybe Tony Benn, is there another figure, or what issues do you think would be used in an updating of a novel?
Well, the issues would certainly be very different. There's no enormous ideological divide now. Market forces have swept all before them. Now, it's true they've come to grief with this great crisis of capitalism that we've seen in the last 3 or 4 years, so nothing is forever. But there's no one who believes in... Oh, well, that's not quite true, is it? If you'd have said a Labour government would end up nationalising 3 banks, they'd have thought you were... In 1997, they'd have said you were bonkers. So you can never tell in politics. But I think it would have to be along the lines that that the new series, Secret State, which is, according to the credits, inspired by rather than based on my novel. They have very kindly paid me for the rights, and I'm immensely grateful for that. Where you've got a government up against a big multinational corporation, because it is corporations at the moment. You've seen yesterday in Parliament they had before them 3 big multinational corporations that don't appear to be paying much or any corporation tax here. It's a corporation tax for many of these big multinational companies has become voluntary, And clearly that is a bit of a threat to democracy, actually. They want our markets, but they don't want to pay taxes on what they earn here.
I remember thinking it was very interesting in 2010 during the coalition negotiations when there was this push to try and get a government in over the weekend for the markets and then having to set out austerity for the markets. And it did remind me, I think, of the early stages of a very British coup. And I think when the Labour government is brought in, then you see the market sort of plummet. And that's, I suppose, the start of the backlash against the Perkins government in the novel. And it does seem to have been quite, I suppose, for, as you say, for a rather obscure left-wing political thriller, it does seem to have entered the British lexicon, doesn't it? A very British coup, it seems to be.
Yes, a very British coup has been in print almost continuously since 1982, when it was first published. It's had about six or seven publishers so far, and we still have trouble getting into W. H. Smith's, even with a television series, a second television series. It is not in W. H. Smith. They just can't get their heads around it. It's extraordinary, isn't it? They've got 2,000 copies and they've left them in a warehouse somewhere.
Is that just Smith's, or is that any of the other major books?
No, they're in every other bookshop, I think. Not in large quantities, but they're there.
I have at least the odd copy.
Yes.
That's very strange, isn't it?
It's extraordinary, isn't it? Yeah. No, it's incompetence. I don't allege conspiracy. It's complete incompetence.
Yeah.
It's a Soviet-style organisation, W. H. Smith.
I can imagine. I mean, when you wrote the novel, you were a quite prominent supporter of Tony Benn. I think you edited a couple of his collections of speeches. And after entering Parliament in 1987 and leaving in 2010, in that period, I suppose you sort of seemed to move from being sort of the Bennite wing of the party to being what I might call one of the more sensible sort of left-wing MPs, being quite sympathetic to Tony Blair, supporting him in 1994. What was it in those 10 or 15 years that sort of... Do you think your views changed, or did your outlook change? What do you think?
On the whole, my views haven't changed. I mean, they have on some things, and clearly the Labour Party's position in 1983 on the European Union, for example, was not credible, though we now seem to swap the Tories
in power.
They were in favour of withdrawal. I think it's perfectly reasonable to ask the Americans to remove their nuclear weapons, and it's become rather more reasonable than it was in 1982 to suggest that we perhaps don't need a new generation of nuclear weapons. So I don't think that's a particularly extreme point of view, and even Tony Blair in his memoirs concedes that the decision to renew the Trident missile system was what he called an unbalanced decision. It wasn't one that was blindingly obvious, and indeed it remains not blindingly obvious to me now. So my views on any of that haven't changed. I'm sure I have mellowed to some extent, and there's nothing like losing three general elections in a row to cause one to recognise that one has to compromise with the electorate. Really, Blair's great achievement was to drag the Labour Party kicking and screaming onto the centre ground of British politics and keep it there for a decade or so. And I don't think that can be taken away from him. I mean, in many respects, it all went wrong after Iraq and so forth. But up to that time, I think that he did mostly the right things.
Moving on, I suppose, to other political issues sort of beyond the novel. In your diaries, I think the first chronological volume, but the third that was published, a lot of times devoted to trying to curb the influence of Rupert Murdoch on British politics. Have you therefore been interested by the events of Leveson? Have you been sort of glued to the television watching the testimonies come in?
I haven't been glued to the television, no, because I do think that the recent implosion of the News of the World and the Murdoch Empire to some extent presents us with the only opportunity in my lifetime, only realistic opportunity, to do what Harry Perkins wanted to do in the novel, and that is break up the big media conglomerates one daily, one Sunday per proprietor and everything else on the market. No one who owns a national newspaper should be allowed to have more than 10% ownership of a television company and so forth. A few rules like that. You could go so far as John Major wished to go, and he was a Tory Prime Minister, and say that only EU citizens should be allowed to own more than 10% stake or whatever in our media. You asked me a moment ago what the issues would be today.
Yes.
And I said corporations. Well, actually, this is one that hasn't changed in the intervening 30 years. No. It's got rather worse, in a way, the grip of companies. It's not only Murdoch. We've now got a pornographer who owns the Daily Express and the Sunday Express and the Daily Star and the Channel 5 television. We've got a couple of tax avoiders who live on a lock in the Channel Islands owning the Daily Telegraph, which has gone sort of doolally since they got control of it. And the Sun is carrying on just like before. At the moment, they're bashing the BBC for all it's worth. Well, they have a commercial interest in doing that because they're part of Sky Television as well.
I mean, do you think that, I know it's perhaps the only realistic opportunity we'll get, but do you think that we will see reform to media ownership, where it seems to me that Leveson's more looking at regulating the content of newspapers, say, trying to talk about, say, regulation of the press, rather than in terms of the content they produce, rather than looking at ownership? Do you think we might see any moves?
I don't think anybody needs to regulate the content, but they do need to clamp down on abuses. And I noticed the newspaper industry, even including The Guardian, which, God help us, is campaigning for no statutory form of complaint system. Now, that's absolutely useless. That means we're going to be back exactly where we were at the beginning, if that happens. So I just hope that Leveson digs his heels in, as I think he might, over a credible system of complaints and restitution. All you need to do is say that when somebody gets it wrong, they need to give equal space and equal prominence to a swift apology. At the moment, in the newspapers, not on television, you'll notice, the Newsnight came straight out and apologised, rightly so, and they gave it probably much more prominence than the original offending feature. But on newspapers, by and large, if they get something spectacularly wrong, the apology appears grudgingly 6 or 7 months later on page 95, even if the offending article was on page one. Well, that needs changing. And I think probably there needs to be a capacity to fine them if they grossly abuse their power. But that doesn't address what I regard as the central issue, and I don't think Leveson will address the central issue. I think he's ducked out of it, which is ownership. He didn't really take much evidence on that, and I think he's probably put that in the too difficult tray.
Yes, I suppose, but interpreting his remit just to be about phone hacking and looking at, I suppose, rogue reporters rather than rogue media owners, do you think?
Well, he had some evidence. I mean, the evidence from, I can't remember what his name was, a former Daily Express journalist who explained how the Daily Express works.
Richard Pepiot, I think.
I think it was. Yeah, you're very well informed. Yes, that is exactly who it was. About how the Daily Express works most days of the week. Ought to have given him a clue to the problem's a bit more than just the odd falsehood that gets perpetrated. It's endemic as far as papers like The Express are concerned.
As a former editor of a newspaper, do you...
Well, a very small one. It mustn't sort of put me on the same bracket as these big ones.
But a good tradition, though, of Michael Foot and George Orwell and all those wonderful writers in Tribune. But what's your opinion on the future of the print media, and especially small magazines like Tribune? I mean, we've seen Newsweek, I think, in America is going to go digital only in the new year.
Is it really?
I think so.
Really? Newsweek magazine is going to disappear, is it?
I think so. I've made that up.
Goodness me.
If I have, I'll have to edit out the interview. But I think some are going online only.
Right.
Do you think that's a viable future? Do you think that's maybe the only future?
Only a viable future if they're able to set up a firewall and people are willing to pay for access to it. If they're not, then there is no viable future. This is why a lot of media outlets are watching with interest. This is the one area where I actually want Murdoch to succeed. With the firewall that he set up around some of his newspapers, the Times, and perhaps some of his American assets too, because no one really knows is the answer.
Mm.
But I teach at Newcastle University on Mondays, and I don't think any of the 60-odd students that I teach are all prosperous middle-class, not all of them, most of them come from prosperous middle-class families. I don't think any of them buy a daily newspaper. Any, naught out of 60, I think.
Hmm.
I may be wrong. They probably all come from homes where their parents buy a daily newspaper. Now, that bodes very ill for the future.
Hmm.
And it's very noticeable that papers like The Guardian are in trouble. Others like The Times are subsidised by other parts of the empire. And this will be one of the problems in breaking up the Murdoch Corporation. If the result was that newspapers just disappeared rather than all became the playthings of another billionaire, that wouldn't be progress. The Guardian, which is by far the best daily newspaper, I would say is in some difficulty, and that would be a great tragedy if anything were to happen to that. They've got a very good website, but it's free. And I don't understand how commercially, I know they can get some advertising on it, but I still don't understand how commercially that's going to work.
So in the long run, do you think that almost all newspapers will have to go the Times route and try and put in some sort of paywall? Because it does seem The Guardian, especially like Alan Musbridge, do seem to be very opposed, I think, on a...
Alan Musbridge is opposed as a matter of principle,
yes.
And I'm sure he knows what he's doing. I hope he does. And he may know anyway that it isn't viable for The Guardian. It's liable only to be viable for those newspapers that have subscribers with what they call a high net worth and decision makers. So papers like the Financial Times, probably the New York Times, Washington Post, maybe Newsweek can get away. The Economist, I'm sure, could get away with that, I think, if anybody can.
Yeah.
Times, I'm not so sure about. We'll see. He's trying it. The fate of newspapers is going to be much different, I think. There may be... Murdoch himself once said, God forbid, that he thought that in 10 or 15 years' time, the only surviving newspapers would be The Sun and the Daily Mail. God, what a desert. What a desert.
Yeah. Trying to choose the morning paper would be very difficult.
They could drive me onto the internet, I think.
And one of the interesting things, I suppose, from Leveson has been what I suppose might be a temporary raising of profile of select committees. You've seen high-profile people like Tom Watson give very forensic questioning at select committee hearings. As someone who got a bit of a reputation as a forensic investigator on the select committee, is there a way of maybe capitalising on that? How do you think we can make select committees better at making Parliament more accountable, or make it more worthwhile for people to go into a select committee, say, than becoming a minister?
Yes, I won't say the questioning's been all that forensic. I was present at the interview with James Murdoch. For one thing, they were calling him James all the time. Well, Mr. Murdoch is what he should be called in these circumstances. And some of them were doing a bit, including Mr. Watson, I'm sorry to say, were doing a bit of grandstanding rather than... but it's true that Tom Watson has played a very positive part in all this overall. I welcome the rise of the Select Committee. People say that Parliament has got less effective. Some even go so far as to say it's all a waste of time. Now, it's quite true that the Chamber has declined as a centre of action, but it's not true of the select committees. And if you look only at the last few year or two, we've had the bankers paraded before the Treasury Select Committee. Yesterday we had some of the big tax avoiders before the Public Accounts Committee. And of course, we've had the humbling of the great oligarch himself, Murdoch, in front of the Culture, Media and Sport Committee. And those were good moments for Parliament, I thought. I do think they need to improve the quality of the questioning. One of the difficulties a select committee faces is you've got 11 people competing to ask the questions, and some of them have got fairly mighty egos, and they're all anxious to get their little soundbite in. One way round that would it be maybe to hire a professional to on big occasions, not every day, to ask the key questions and maybe let the MPs chip in section by section, so that there is some sort of forensic questioning. When I chaired the Home Affairs Select Committee, we had a big set too with the Chief Freemason, and I did say to the others that the only way you're going to corner this guy is if you let me ask the questions, because A, I know all about it, B, we need a consistent line of questioning, and we did, and it worked very well.
Just quickly on Freemason, I find one of the more interesting things, I suppose, in the first chronological volume of Diaries was the attention that was paid to Freemasons, because as someone who wasn't really politically aware at the time, wasn't, I suppose, really old enough to understand the machinations, it seemed very very odd that there was this attention paid to Freemasons. Was it quite a big...
Well, it was one of my little campaigns. To be honest, there's a lot of unjustified paranoia about Freemasons, but there's no doubt that in some professions they have been a malign influence. I think their influence is declining, like all organised activity these days, you know, whether it's the churches, the scouts, whatever it is, it's their influence is declining, and the Freemasons lodge is just around the corner for County Diamonds, just around the corner from where I live, and I see them going in and out, and they're all a bit elderly and grey. A Tory MP who knew all about them once said to me it was the aristocracy of the mediocre, which I think is a rather good phrase. But there is no doubt that especially in the uniform, anything that comes with a uniform, they are drawn to masonry. It was certainly true of police, ambulance service. In some areas, it varied immensely. It depended how energetic, I suppose, the local lodge was. Police, ambulance, fire brigades, all the promotion structure was in some cases Masonic, and magistrates, funnily enough, though they don't wear uniforms, quite a lot of magistrates were Masons, and the armed forces as well, in the police, part of the problem was that it tended to be the elite squads. The West Midlands Serious Crime Squad, for example, had a number of Masons. I'm not sure how decisive a fact. Many of them were villains, and there was a culture of villainy that extended well beyond Freemasonry in that particular squad. But half a dozen of the key members were also Masons, as I eventually discovered.
Okay. So I suppose, just to go back to the select committees, do you think... I suppose, pet theories has been that maybe one way of increasing the ability of the select committee to cross-examine people is, I suppose, as you say, trying to bring in outside people. Do you think there's a case for hiring QCs or maybe having more outside people just to sit who might have more expertise of an issue rather than just MPs, or do you think it's quite important?
Well, the select committees have the power already and do, on occasion, hire experts as far as who suggest a line of questioning very often.
Okay.
The only way you could take that further is to, as you just said, hire a lawyer to lead the questioning. And as I say, that's something you could do occasionally, on a big occasion, I think, if you had the bankers coming, who will all have been rehearsing for a long time what their answers are going to be. So you do need to be consistent. And it's not helpful if you're just getting somewhere with a line of questioning, and when your time's up and you have to switch to one of your colleagues who wants to go off down a completely different track. So you've got to be aware of that, yes.
Yeah, because it seemed to me, watching the Murdoch testimony, that you had, I suppose, maybe two or three, Tom Watson, to a lesser extent Louise Mensch, who seemed to have a little bit of an idea of the issue and what was going on, whereas the rest were, as you say, more interested in trying sound bites or didn't really seem to have a bit of a firm grip of the issue.
I think Louise Mensch's principal interest was in Louise Mensch, to be perfectly honest.
It does seem that way, doesn't it? I suppose moving on to another contemporary issue. I mean, you knew David Cameron since he entered Parliament. I think you were...
Well, he was on my committee, yes.
On the Home Affairs.
Yes, when he was first elected in 2001, for a year or so, maybe a bit more, he was on the Home Affairs Select Committee when I was the chairman, yeah.
Are you, to put it rather bluntly, Are you rather surprised by the incompetence of his government? Because I know you wrote rather highly of him in your diaries and seen someone who did seem quite bright and quite capable, which is not necessarily something that you could say about his administration.
Well, I spotted quite early, I like to think, as you can see from the diaries, that he was going to go far. I didn't realise quite how far, how fast. As regards the alleged incompetence of his government, well, of course, he's got a lot of, any Prime Minister's got a lot of fish to fry. He's not actually totally in command. He's got a third Liberal Democrats who don't wish to be there. Many of the Liberals don't wish to be in a Tory-dominated coalition. Some of the ministers are very happy to be there. He's got troublesome backbenchers who are obsessed with the European Union, which is always a big fault line in the Tory party. There is a big economic crisis that has to be addressed, and that will be the case if Labour was in government. So I have a bit of sympathy with the fact that things go wrong from time to time, because I'm sure they would if any other party happened to be in government. And goodness knows, in the last 3 years of the Labour government, there was evidence of occasional incompetence. Where I think he made quite a big mistake, but Labour made it too, was in the relationship with the Murdoch Empire. In what successive Prime Ministers, certainly Blair and Brown and Cameron, attempted to do, instead of taking on the oligarchs who control much of what we see and read, they attempted to ride the tiger instead. In Blair's case, with quite successful results. It neutralised Murdoch, at least for 7 or 8 years. But it's ended in tears for both of them, really, for all of them, really. Murdoch turned on Labour eventually, viciously. The Sun turned on Labour viciously in the end. Cameron made the mistake of hiring a former senior executive from the Murdoch Empire with...
Yes, and Andy Coulson.
Yes. Yeah. And it's been very interesting, these various inquiries, to see how, for example, Rebecca Wade has wormed her way into the affections of the last three Prime Ministers, regardless of their politics or anything. There's a little clip of film which is occasionally shown of her embracing Blair, Brown and Cameron, sort of one by one. And then these emails from this little love affair that she appeared to be conducting with Cameron. I use love affair in the political sense.
Yes.
Which I think was entirely cynical from her point of view. I don't think... The point was... he was the Prime Minister, not that she was necessarily ideologically one way or another interested.
How do you think Ed Miliband can, in your words, try and ride the tiger? Because he did come out very strongly against the News of the World trying to take on Rupert Murdoch. It's, I suppose, on the one hand, going very hard for him to backtrack and then try and get the Sun's endorsement. On the other hand, probably the Sun wouldn't try and give it to him as well. But if you were advising him, what would be the best thing?
I think the time for riding the tiger is past. These guys are busted flush now, and they need to be taken on. When Blair cozied up to Murdoch, I felt in a way that was a sensible thing to do, because we had just lost three general elections in a row, and the Sun had played a part in our misery over the preceding 18 years, and one had to recognise that, and something had to be done about it. Now, I think, given the implosion of the News of the World, we've got plenty of ammunition we can throw at these guys. I would take them on. I would be talking about some structural reforms to the media ownership. The idea that we have a free press in this country is nonsense. And listening to them all bashing the BBC, which is by far and away the highest standards of journalism in this country, although it occasionally falls below them, is truly sickening. Would help if the BBC wouldn't keep bashing itself, mind you.
Well, it's got engaged in self-flagellation, isn't it?
Dreadful, the last few days, yes.
I watched the news on, I think it was Saturday night, and the first 20 or 25 minutes were all about the BBC.
Talking about itself.
Yes. On the ticker tape, you've got, the problems in Syria, Greece is defaulting.
And the BBC is disappearing up its own what have you.
Well, quite.
Well, I hope they snap out of it soon.
So if I can, I suppose, move on Tony Benn, when he said that he was going to, and an MP said that he was going to have more time for politics. Have you found that since 2010?
Well, interestingly, I have, yes. And that comes as quite a surprise. If you read the last volume of the diary, you'll see there's a great deal of, after I've decided to stand down, which I did 2 years before I retired, you'll see there's a great deal of agonising about whether I've made the right decision and whether there's any useful role for me in the world beyond. Mm-hmm. But the good news is that a small industry has developed around the diaries, and I spend an enormous amount of time going to literary festivals and other events, universities. Many of the invitations are prompted by the diaries. Mm-hmm. I did three last week. I spoke at Eton on Tuesday. I gave a public lecture at Sunderland University on Thursday. And I spoke at a literary festival in Leicester on Saturday. And 3 weeks ago, I did six in various parts of the country, all over the country. I've done at least 100 since I... just about the diaries. I've done many other things besides. Since I retired. And what I've discovered is that the political meeting is not dead. Mm-hmm. It is simply transferred to the literary festival, where people pay 8, 9, 10 quid a head to come and listen. And where I get audiences of up to 700 people. Whereas if I... if somebody stuck a notice on a church hall in the centre of Sunderland and said Chris Mullin will be here,
you make it seven.
By the way, it'll cost you 8 quid to get in. I don't think it would be a very large meeting.
No.
So that's not bad, is it? 3 years running, I've had full houses at the Edinburgh Festival, which is 550 people a time. And I won't say all the meetings are that size, but they're usually, most of the seats are full, whatever the size of the meeting.
I mean, did you write the diaries originally for publication? I know you started writing them about the after the death of John Smith. Was that almost to try and get your own thoughts in order, or was it more with a view to publication?
Well, if I'm honest, because I'm a writer by profession, I always thought they'd be published. I always thought I'd try to get them published. I had no idea whether anybody would be interested, to be perfectly honest. So, publication was always likely, I think. I didn't anticipate publishing them quite as quickly as I did. I published the first volume while I was still in Parliament. And I was pressed by my agent and the publishers to do that. And I thought it was too close to the events concerned. But I think they were right in terms of actually arousing some interest.
Right.
Because interest is aroused according to how close you are to the events described. So, for example, we published them out of sequence, and we published the first volume that starts with the death of John Smith and covers the rise of New Labour, as it were, has only been published recently.
Mm-hmm. After they were published, when you were in Parliament, did you get MPs who... I can almost see it going two ways. Either MPs knowing, oh, well, Chris Mullin is keeping a diary, I'm not going to speak to him, or... Chris Mullin's keeping a diary. It'd be great to talk to him and try and get...
Well, that's very perceptive of you, because that's the second thing. There were one or two people who were upset regarding being quoted in the first volume, and I regret that, and I should have been more careful and anonymised some of the quotes in two or three cases. I should have done, and I do regret that. And I was more careful in the next two volumes. Yes, it was something I noticed during my last couple of years in Parliament when something interesting was happening. Far from running away from me, people would come up to me to make sure that I got their version of events. Because, as you know, when a politician goes into a bookshop and looks up a political book, he always runs... The first thing he does is turn to the index and see whether his name is in there. Do you know the story about Paddy Ashdown and Don Foster?
I don't think so.
Don Foster bought a copy of Paddy Ashdown's diaries and got Paddy to sign them for him. And when Don got home, he opened the book at the index. And when he got to his name, he found that Paddy had written in the margin, "Hi, Don, I thought you'd look here first."
Ah, that's fantastic. Do you think diaries are... I suppose you probably do have a slightly biased view on this, perhaps, but do you think diaries are almost a better way for a politician to... communicate their views than the political memoir, because the autobiographies always do seem terribly self-justificatory after the event, whereas I suppose this diary is more of a sort of living record where a politician can show himself, I suppose, to be human. It's quite interesting, I think, looking at the volume about the rise of New Labour and looking at the increasingly apocalyptic predictions for Labour in the 1997 election, saying that not sure if we're going to get a majority or not. And it's the sort of thing that you can imagine being airbrushed out of a normal member.
Yes. So when people ask me, as they do sometimes at literary festivals, have you improved them with hindsight and cut out the things you were wrong about, I point to the fact that even a week before the 1997 general election, there are entries saying, I think we're going to lose. I mean, to be fair, I changed my mind the following day, but I could easily cut that out, but I didn't. I left it in. Yes, so it shows me warts and all, hopefully. I am a bit of a pessimist by nature, and I think a flavour of my pessimism comes through in the diaries. But that must always be a temptation. If you publish the diaries just as a way of showing what a great guy you were and how you were always right about everything, I don't think there'd be much interest in them. And it's true with political memoirs too. And those higher up the pecking order often tend to write about how they save the world rather than warts and all. Although I must say that a lot of the New Labour literature is, and there's been a considerable New Labour literature, memoirs, Alistair Darling, Jack Straw, Tony Blair, and some people further down the pecking order, Bob Marshall Andrews, for example, and Una King. And it's of a fairly high quality. I found most of them of interesting. There was a very good book by Jonathan Powell, who was the chief of staff in Tony Blair's office, which is called The New Machiavelli, which is also about the New Labour from the inside. And it's pretty good, I thought. On the course is Alistair Campbell's diaries, which are very long, but because he enjoyed total access, will be of interest to historians.
Slightly moving on a bit. So, as I say, there's a little sort of cottage industry built up around the diaries. But so, as well as speaking about the diaries, are there any other... I mean, you mentioned that you were teaching as well. Are there any other...
What do I do? Yes, I'm the chairman of the Heritage Lottery Fund for the northeast of England, which is something I enjoy very much. I lecture just very part-time in the autumn term in Newcastle University. I do a number of other things, like I'm on the council of the Winston Churchill Scholarship Trust, which gives travelling scholarships to people who want to go and improve their knowledge of something or other, and when they get home, impart their knowledge. I'm on a few things like that. But plus, there is this industry that has developed around the diaries. I spend a lot of time... I get asked to review books quite a lot by half a dozen national newspapers, which I enjoy doing, and I occasionally get to write articles in newspapers like The Times, which I'm very happy to do.
Yeah, I saw one recent one about the Andrew Mitchell.
Oh yes.
And that I thought was very, very perceptive, sort of trying to give you the side of the story, because I suppose it was everyone trying to...
I thought Andrew Mitchell was very badly treated. He was a good minister. He was the International Development Secretary in a party where there's not an enormous interest in international development. Well, he was very good.
Justine Greening, I suppose, has proved that.
Well, I don't know about her, but there's not much interest, I can tell you that.
Right.
And the Tory party. But he was very good and committed. I didn't think the Police Federation, and it was the Police Federation who were driving the campaign, should be allowed to reshuffle the government. And I also don't believe he called them plebs, whatever else he said to them.
What do you think of Labour sort of, almost, I suppose, jumping on the bandwagon with the police? Are you sort of...
I don't approve of it. The police would do exactly the same to us. The Police Federation would and did. Labour Home Office ministers... regularly used to undergo ritual humiliation at Police Federation conferences, just like they do with the current ministers. I would have a much more hands-off relationship with the Police Federation. There's nothing to be gained by sucking up to them.
Okay. I suppose, just to finish off, I mean, as obviously, it almost sounds like you don't have much time to write, perhaps beyond the odd book review, but if you... got any more ideas for a novel?
I have got one or two ideas for a couple of other pieces of writing. Not necessarily a novel, but possibly. And in due course, I hope to find the time to do that. But yes, at the moment, I am extremely busy.
Mm-hmm.
As busy as I was when I was a Member of Parliament. The other thing I want to do is grow vegetables.
And write a novel about growing vegetables, maybe?
No, I have no plans to write a novel about growing vegetables, but I have acquired a garden in Northumberland where I intend to do that.
Fantastic.
So that's going to take a bit of time in the near future.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic. I think we'll leave that there. Thank you very much. That's great. Thank you.
You can also watch Secret State and A Very British Coup on the 4OD channel on YouTube. And you can buy A Very British Coup in all bookshops, apart from WH Smith's, it seems. This was Corey Hazelhurst for The Pod Delusion.
Thank you for listening to this special podcast brought to you by The Pod Delusion. You can listen to the rest of episode 163 at poddelusion.co.uk. But for now, thanks for listening.